that, I'm going to hand the meeting over to Shelley.
Thanks, Dave. Hello, my name's Shelley, I'm an addict.
Hiya, Shelley.
I'm going to start with kind of how I'm feeling, because it's like I've got a big lump in my stomach, but it's just in flip-flops. I've got a big lump in my throat, which is just going round and round and round and round and round, and I kind of want to choke, and I also really want to just burst into tears. And I can kind of feel this trembling through my knees and my legs and my arms. And I just want to start with that, because a few years ago, I would not have been in touch with myself enough to experience what was going on in my body. And gradually, as I've gone on in recovery, I've kind of thawed out and I've become more and more in touch with myself. This is a really, really big deal for me, sitting here doing this. I've done the 15-minute share quite a few times, and thank you, Kai. It was a really lovely, lovely share. We were met up outside, and he's kind of like, sharing, oh yeah, I'm sharing, oh yeah, and I'm sharing too. And I was like, great, do you want to swap? But he wouldn't, so I suppose I can't really change the format of the meeting at such short notice. And then I was kind of like, maybe I can do like a guided meditation for half an hour. All these things to just stop me revealing me, because it's kind of like that self-obsession that Kai talked about, you know, it's very prevalent in me at the moment. At this particular moment in time, it isn't always as prevalent and as strong now as it was when I first came into recovery. But yeah, that kind of self-obsession kind of tells me that I'm not good enough, that what I say, nobody will identify with, because I'm so special and different, and that I don't really belong here, although I kind of managed to get that one out a few years ago. You know, and just that, you know, you'll all be bored, you'll all go home and really complain about the share. And then the other extreme of my addiction and my head and my self-obsession says that unless I kind of get a standing ovation and calls for encore at the end, I won't have done good enough. And that's kind of how my addiction really plays out. It's kind of going through extremes, one extreme to the other. So I don't know whether I was born an addict or if I just became an addict. I know I kind of had really addictive tendencies from a really young age. I kind of used to pretend I had a stomachache, so my mum would give me gripe water, which, if anyone knows what gripe water is, it's kind of like an alcohol-based child's thing to settle your stomach. And I kind of remember not having a stomachache at all and saying that I had just so I could have that. And the usual kind of like going away on holidays and, you know, necking the ends of drinks from adults. And, you know, I don't exactly know what age I was when I started doing that. I just remember kind of always doing it. I didn't remember a lot of my childhood when I came into recovery. I kind of had great big blanks. Had quite a mad upbringing. My real dad died when I was 2 of a drugs overdose. Him and my mum had me very young. They weren't really together, I don't think. I've got an older half-brother and older half-sister out there somewhere that I've never met. One day I will get round to tracing them, kind of through my dad's side. And then I've got a younger half-brother, younger half-sister, although I kind of do see them as my real brother and sister through my stepdad and my mum. I kind of grew up in a very addictive household. My mum is still kind of like pretty much a functioning addict, if you call it functioning, says my stepdad, you know, kind of on the outside it kind of looks okay. And I might talk a bit later about my family dynamics and stuff, because later. But yeah, it was a very kind of turbulent upbringing. I left home when I was very young. The whole acid house scene was kind of kicking off then, and I kind of found my way into it. You know, before I found drugs and alcohol, you know, I was always very much, but bear in mind, I've been thinking quite a lot about this lately, because over the last year or so, a lot more of my kind of childhood memories have been coming back, and not just memories, but actually kind of experiencing them, feeling them in my body, which is kind of probably why it's unlocking that I can do it now. Just kind of why I mentioned it at the beginning, because it's quite a big deal for me, because I never ever used to be as connected to myself as I am today, and to other people, and that's down to this program and the people in it and the people I have in my life today. So I've lost my tread. Got my little prompt sheet here, just of little things in case I lose my way. And it's funny because I was noticing, like, when this group started, and this was our first ever book, and I did this writing right at the beginning. I don't know if you can see it, but it's really, really neat and precise. And then it's like, you look at my writing now, and it's just a complete and utter mess. And as Rachel very kindly pointed out, that's probably a good thing for you. And it is, because I was so kind of like, you know, frozen when I came in here. And I spent quite a bit of my early recovery really just so scared and so frightened. So I kind of just surrounded myself in service, surrounded myself in doing everything precisely and doing everything the right way, because it's kind of like that obsessive nature that I have also plays out in my having obsessive compulsive disorder. And I kind of always, you know, especially before I came to recovery, I always had to try and do everything perfectly, and if I didn't get everything absolutely perfect, then it was just wrong, and I was just a failure, and I just had to get, you know, it's just doomed. I might as well just give up, might as well just forget all about it because I'd made some tiny little mistake. I'm not like that today, thank God. But yeah, sorry, we were kind of going around the houses a little bit. So yeah, I left home when I was really young. And yeah, as I said, I, you know, lost myself in fantasy, reading. I was always very much lonely when I was a child. I didn't even really connect that much with people then, if I'm honest. And when I actually started using substances, it just opened up a whole life for me. It was just so freeing. I mean, it kind of started. It actually started, I was in hospital for about a year when I was really young. I was kind of in and out, had quite a serious illness, which meant I had to have quite a lot of surgery. And I think even, you know, even then it was set off. And recently, maybe a couple of years ago, I kind of remembered being in hospital and getting into really big, big trouble, because I kind of had a little, for quite a while I was on an adult ward. I don't know why I was on the adult ward, not on a child ward. They might just have not had space, but they always used to leave the drugs trolley in my little cubbyhole thing. And I suppose because I was so young, because I was like literally, I mean, I was over eight to ten, I was in and out of hospital a lot, and I was kind of in it most of the time. I suppose they thought there was no problem with leaving the drugs trolley near me. And basically, they found a stash underneath my pillow of pills, just all different pills. And, you know, I'd just been nicking them and just kind of stashing them. And I kind of remember doing it and not even really knowing why I was doing it. But yeah, even then, it's just like, you know, I could kind of see how this is. Because when I got into recovery, I really thought, maybe I can learn to not be an addict, because my mum uses, my stepdad uses, that my mum, you know, they use quite hard drugs up until about the age of 6, 7 when my little brother came along. And then they went, you know, just kind of smoked dope, and alcohol was just very, you know, accepted in our family. And I think they thought because they weren't using hard drugs anymore, it was okay. But yeah, I remember going to a party at the age of 12 and someone passing me a spliff, and they go, oh no, you won't want that one. And it was like, and I could smell that sweet smell, and I knew it was heroin. I knew that that was what my mum had been before. I kind of knew it instantly. I didn't smoke it, I did smoke lots of drugs though, but not heroin. And so yeah, I mean, So when I left home, it was just like squats, lots more drugs, and I mean, I was just off. I was just off and running. I was very lucky in that I didn't end up on the streets. I had a career that I got spotted on and kind of managed to have, you know, work and kind of just about managed to scrape through my GCSEs at school while I was kind of like working at weekends and working in the holidays. And again, I mean, that kind of preciseness, that kind of self-sufficiency, just really, you know, the obsessive compulsive part of me just kind of kicked in. And, you know, I kind of always managed to, you know, I looked a lot older than I was, so I was able to lie about my age. I was able to get, through the work that I was doing, I was able to get flats and couldn't keep them for very long, but I would get flats. And basically the careers and the circles that I moved in were all based in drugs, just completely. And as my using progressed, I would just move on to the next set of people whose using was worse than mine, so that then I could kind of hide in there so nobody would kind of notice my using, and I could always go, well, at least I'm not like that, at least I'm not using like that. And it just went on that way for quite a lot of years. And when I came to NA, I was absolutely broken inside. I learned in my first few months of being around that I was actually going psychotic. I did have a history of a long history of depression in my using, also from a very early age. And what I learned through being here the first few months, that the symptoms I was experiencing the last few months of my using, I was actually going psychotic. And my life was really beginning to get outwardly unmanageable those last few months. Like, I started to get red bills. You know, I'd always kind of worked, I'd always been, and I couldn't go anywhere. My money was rapidly running out. I was beginning to sell things. You know, I could only really go out to get my drugs. I couldn't do anything else. And for me, I didn't even think that I could give up using, because I'd always kind of got to a point where I was like, okay, well, I will stop using, but... And then when it got to that point when I thought, yeah, I'm going to stop using then, it'd be like, well, I'll just do it in a couple of weeks when this crisis is over and this is over. And I didn't really need an excuse to use. I kind of used, if good things happened, if bad things happened, if nothing happened, I'd make something up to use. And I was always kind of creating crises and dramas and... You know, I could kind of handle big dramas. I don't quite know why, but you know, I was great in a, you know, big crisis. I was great, but it's always the little things that just used to completely tip me over the edge. But yeah, when I came to NA, I was broken, and there's a few people in this room that was around when I first came in. And as I said, this meeting is very close to my heart. Because I got involved with service here when it started, and it was very early in my recovery. And so it's such a big deal for me to sit here and do this chair. I've done the 15-minute chair quite a few times, but the 40 minutes is a big one, because there's a lot of people I care about in this room. There's a lot of people whose recovery I really respect. And, you know, I still have that thing of wanting to impress you, wanting you to like me. I'm better with not just wanting everybody to like me, like, I don't know, the cashier in the supermarket, but the people that I respect and I care about, you know, I do want to. I do want them to. And it's also, as time's gone on in my recovery, I feel like I have a responsibility to carry a message of recovery. I did have quite a lot of yets, but I've learned here that they are only yets. I wasn't injecting. I was with somebody who was injecting, that's a whole other story. And I kind of only injected when I was hospitalised, but God did I love my morphine drip. I have a secondary illness, which I've had since that time when I was in hospital that I mentioned when I was a child, which was undiagnosed until a few years before I came into recovery. And through that, on the one hand, it actually really helped me, because at that time, if I'd carried on using the way that I was and with the people that I was using with, I very much doubt I would be here today. My illness literally flattened me, but it didn't stop me using. I came in here thinking I had a problem because I smoked an ounce and a half of skunk a week. I didn't realise that all the prescription pills I was cross-addicting with were an issue too, but I've been abusing those for many, many years. As I said, I have this secondary illness, and at the time I had different specialists for every single system in my body, and I could hit them all for drugs, and I had a GP in the country, I had a GP in London, and I just had piles of prescriptions ready to be filled. I had drugs in my cupboard all the time. And then it was funny, because one of my biggest examples of insanity that I realised when I came round was when I was able to start walking and kind of functioning again a bit more on a level of just breathing and eating, because for a while I was couldn't really walk properly, I couldn't really do very much, I couldn't really speak. This was before I got into recovery. My main overriding want to get better, so I can't think of the word. I just remember thinking, I just want to get better so I can start going out and using again, so I can just start going out and snorting the coke and taking the ease and doing all the things that I've been doing for so many years. And that was my, you know, and I spent lots of money, lots of energy, lots of time getting better, because I was told that I wouldn't get better. And my overriding thing was I wanted to get better so I could go out and use. And that was kind of one of the easiest things for me to see that was insane about my behaviour when I came in. So yes, recovery has just been amazing. You know, I used to wake up every day wanting to die, not wanting to live. I'd wake up every single day thinking, oh God, not again. And as I said, before I got to recovery, I didn't even think I could stop using. And I'd kind of given up. And it took me quite a while to kind of have any kind of faith that I could get this. It wasn't that I didn't believe it working, because I could see it working in you guys. I just didn't believe that I was worth it. I didn't believe I was worth recovery. I just didn't. You know, I had no problem with thinking there was something bigger than me. I didn't think I was worth it. And this program has been so loving. And you guys have been so loving. You know, when they have that thing about, you know, we'll love you until you love yourself. It's so true. And in the beginning, I just had to start liking myself, let alone loving myself. And it's all just gradually happened. And the program is amazing. It's like all the different aspects of it kind of helped me so much in different ways. Like, I was so disconnected when I came here, as I mentioned earlier, disconnected from myself, disconnected from other people. And slowly, you know, that has changed. And the first time I really felt connected was when I did my first step 5. That was the first time I really kind of felt really connected to another human being. And it was the most amazing experience. I'd never had that before. I wasn't really lonely before I got into recovery, because I'd kind of always had my drugs. I only really started feeling lonely when I kind of had been clean for a while. Yeah, so that connection has been amazing, and the more I kind of connect to myself and to other and my higher power, the more I can connect to other people. The first few years, I was kind of like, first couple of years, I was kind of like, yeah, well, if I've got a connection to a higher power, then I don't, you know, a connection to my sponsor, and do my service, and I work my steps, and I don't need other people. I really don't need other people, but really, I was just really scared. Scared of being vulnerable. You know, I came in very, very damaged. I came in with a long history of abuse, just from people. I kind of came in and I was really kind of like a bit of a door, you know, I was a complete doormat, you know, I kind of really, while I was using, I kind of bought people. I wanted your validation. I wanted your friendship. I wanted you to like me. So I'd buy you everything. I'd do anything for you except share my drugs. But I would do what I could. I'd be who you wanted me to be. I'd never be me. And I actually thought that was an asset, being able to just change into someone completely different at the drop of the hat, or just kind of meld myself into something. And it really, really isn't. I started off learning what I didn't like, rather than what I liked. Because everyone was like, yeah, you can get to know yourself in recovery, and yeah, it's great. And I'd be like, how do you do that? How do you get to know yourself? How do you work that out? And for me, it just started very, but service was just one of the biggest things for that, because I could try out different roles and I could try out different functions. I could find out what I was good at, what I was like. It also kind of got people to know me. And it also gave me self-esteem, and I really, really needed that when I first came in. Working the steps has been the most amazing process for me. I have been through all the steps. I didn't mention how clean I am. I'm going to be 6 years in August, God willing. And I've been up to 9, did a little bit of 9 with my first sponsor. I've been through 1 to 12 with my current sponsor, and then I did another 1 to 9, just in a certain specific area last year, on the advice of my sponsor. And what can I say? Every single step I've come to, I've thought, I can't do this. How can I do that? It seemed like some huge mountain, and then I kind of do it, and I complete it, and I get over it. And it's just like, yeah, that was not anywhere near as bad as I thought it was going to be. And it's been the most loving, kindest, gentlest thing that I've done for myself. And yeah, I can't believe I've been talking for this long already, so I haven't got time to go through them all kind of one by one, because I wanted to be so precise. But just, if you haven't done them, do them. At least just give yourself a chance and just say, I'll just get to, just give yourself little goals. That's what I did. Okay, well, I'll just do 3 then. And I didn't feel very great for a while in recovery. And I kind of said to myself, okay, well, if I get to this point and I still feel shit, I'll just drop it all, I'll just drop it all in. I'll just give it all up. And I said to myself, I'll do the 12 steps, and if I don't feel good, then I'll just forget about it all and give it all up. And I kind of got to about, well, I got to 4 and 5, and kind of knew that I wasn't, that I was going to get better and I was going to continue this, and I didn't have to go back to how I was before. And I think it was around kind of like a 2 and 3, one of my first 2 and 3s I did, because I've, as well as what I've done, I did a 1 to 3 in treatment. I did go to a day program for about 9 months after my last relapse, which was my second relapse in recovery. My first year, I relapsed a couple of times. And maybe I should mention that a little bit, because my second relapse was hell. I basically ended up with my partner, who I'd been with, I wasn't really with them, but what those abusing relationships are like, who was injecting heroin, who'd given me heroin, which I hadn't really known about, which was probably what helped bring me to my knees. He was a lovely fellow. The first night we got together, he'd actually spiked my drink with ecstasy. And do you know, this is another insane thing. He kind of let me know about that a couple of months later, and I thought, oh, he must really love me. I kind of went back to this. I'd been out to see him, and I hadn't been using, and I'd been clean in NA, and of course I was doing the codependent thing of trying to get him into recovery, leading by example and not using. And I relapsed because my plane was late. Like, well, actually, I realised because I wasn't working this programme, I didn't have any defence against this. That's why I relapsed. Yeah, my plane was late. I thought I'd just have a couple of drinks. I was on the plane, up the back, getting the stewardess to give me more little bottles so I can neck them before the plane landed, and then that was it. I was off. He was really, really happy that I was using, of course. And said, oh, and he had to go off for some conference, and he was like, oh, yeah, well, you know where everything is, because there's like a special place where we where he kept all the drugs, and that was a great big bag of heroin there. And that's what I spent the next 2 weeks doing, drinking alcohol, smoking spliff, and then getting completely comatose on smack. And I had such a struggle just even getting back to England. And I remember he was due back, and I was like, I've got to get out of here before he gets back. And it took me 24 hours to just book the flight, to change my flight to come back, and I kept seeing the flights going, and just, okay, well, I'm gonna book myself on the next one. It's like, okay, well, I'll just have something, just take the edge off, and you know, I'll do it in a minute, and I'd see these go. And I'm really lucky I made it back. I have no doubt if I hadn't made it back to England, I don't know, I'd be dead by now, or, you know, still using with him in Naples. Yeah, so the steps. I think something I can say generally about the steps is that I found them a very cleansing, healing process. I believe working them and not acting out on my defects as much as I can keeps my connection to my higher power strong. I feel like the steps have kind of cleansed my soul, you know, and cleansed my soul. And when I act out on my defects, or I don't act according to spiritual principles, which it sometimes, it's like another little, you know, it kind of puts a little bit of dirt there, it kind of weakens that. And when I'm kind of like in my obsessions and going round and round and round, which I've tried to stop as much as possible, but I'd be lying if I said I haven't thought about doing this yet every single spare second I've had for the last couple of days. You know, that kind of stops me connecting, stops me being able to listen and hear what my higher power is kind of trying to guide me to do. I'm very much like, step three is a really important one for me, because it's not just about accepting my higher power's will for me, which it is, and I don't know what my higher power is, but I don't have to understand it for it to work. But it's also, for me, it's about accepting outside help, outside advice, help from you guys, support from you guys, and listening to my doctors when they advise me about what is best for my health, even though I don't want to do it. And yeah, just being less self-sufficient and less that I have to be in control of everything. Step three was such a relief for me, because it was like, oh, you mean I don't have to be in control of everything? I can just kind of let things play. And that doesn't mean I don't take action, because I do. I put in the action, but I let go of the results. And for me, turning my will over isn't absolving responsibility. It's more just trying to align myself with what is right. And in recovery, it's kind of like, it's become less clear cut. Like, it's not so much a question of what's right and what's wrong. You know, my, you know, that was quite easy for me early in recovery. It's like, as recovery's gone on, it's more about what is the right choice for me, because it isn't necessarily, you know, I could have three different choices and none of them are wrong as such. But it's just, what do I do? And it's like that saying in recovery, isn't it? Which I always used to hear the first half of, but not the second. But it's like, as you go on in recovery, your path gets narrower, but your horizons get wider. And I'd always hear the first half of that, and not the second. But I really like the horizons getting wider, because that's really what I've experienced and what I experience. Like, at the moment, I'm in a real state of flux. I've got no idea what's going to happen with my life the next few months. I'm literally just kind of putting loads of action. I'm just going to see what the results are and what I've got in mind, my plans for me, might not happen. And if it doesn't happen, do you know what? I'm okay with that, because I know from my past experience, if I put in the action, things don't work out the way I want them to. It's because my higher power has got a much better plan for me. And while it might be frustrating to not know what that plan is, I've had the experience and the faith, my own faith now, because when I came in, I kind of just used your faith for a while. I used your hope for a while. I know everything will turn out all right, and I never used to have that. So, yeah, God, I finally kind of looked at this once. I'm like, oh my God, there's so much I haven't mentioned. But one thing I will kind of talk briefly about as well is I've really come to see how my higher power works for me by kind of seeing all the synchronicities in my life. Just kind of like those odd little coincidences that might only mean something to me, and some of them are really quite amazing. But I don't like the word coincidences. I like synchronicities. When there's loads of little synchronicities happening, I kind of know I'm on the right track, and I kind of know it's all right. Like for instance, this is quite a weird one. And like even my friends at football just don't even believe this has happened. They're like, it's so much a fix. It's a fix. I follow football, as probably quite a few of you know, and I have a season ticket, and I won the match day ball at the beginning of last season. And everyone was like, oh wow, that's amazing, that's so cool, that's so great. Except this was at a time in my life when I was just like, I'd kind of reached a bit of a bottom, like, not as bad as when I walked through the door. I've never felt as raw or as vulnerable or as bad as I have when I've walked through the door. If I ever felt like that, I would not have kept coming back. If I hadn't have changed, I would not have kept coming back. But I was going through a pretty rocky period, and so I got this match day ball, and it was great, and it was lovely. It was in my bedroom. I'm very happy with it, from a Champions League match. And then, like literally 2 months later, not even that, there was a celebration of 125 years. And there was like 100 lucky ticket winners. And this is in a stadium of, I don't know how many people we get. We always sell out. I just thought I'd mention that. it's kind of 65,000 odd people, thank you. And there was like 20 signed shirts. And like 60 balls to be won. And I got a golden ticket. I won another ball. And this is why my friends around me think it's such a fix, because how did that happen, that coincidence happen, or synchronicity happen in such a short space of time to me? At a time when, although people around me don't really know so much football, maybe a couple of them did, my close friends, at a time when I was just in a real state and really in need of a bit of a boost, a bit of a kind of like reassurance that everything was going to be okay. And it was like, literally, Arsenal gave me a pair of balls. That's kind of like what I say. And it's true. It's like all the people around me just don't believe that I got these. They just think it's a fix. I can't believe I just said that. not in public, and it's being recorded anyway. But yeah, what can I say? I'm relieved this is nearly over. I'm kind of glad I made you all laugh, because that was one of the things. I was like, God, if nobody laughs, I'm just going to walk away in shame. And I know I'm going to come out of here thinking, oh my God, I didn't say that. I should have said this. I should have said that. It's my head. Oh yeah, by the way, with the ball, when I won the matchday ball, my first thought wasn't, great, I've won a ball. Was, yeah, but we've sold Cesc Fabregas now. I haven't got a chance of meeting him after the match. And even when I won the other anniversary ball, it was, why didn't I get a signed shirt? Do you know what I mean? And that is such, the addict thinking part of me, that you just like focus on what I haven't got, when in actual fact I've got everything that I needed and more. And I continue to get that. I don't always get what I want, but I've learned that I always get what I need, and sometimes, most of the time, what I need is a lot better than what I wanted anyway. And thanks very much for listening. I'll leave it there.